A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
7 in the morning, on the dot, a jackhammer starts in the bedroom wall. Daniel's been living with this for months now, and the sound arrives with the precision of a Swiss train and the subtlety of a dental drill. He's got a 14-month-old son, a wife who needs to be central, a decade of Jerusalem rentals behind him, and a brain that, by his own description, can't filter the noise out. He's tried custom earplugs, he's written to the construction company, he's even fed excavation photos to an AI to ask how long this will go on. The answer came back, possibly years. So Daniel's question to us isn't just how to soundproof a bedroom, it's how to survive psychologically when the noise is unpredictable, the lease is a trap, and every past attempt to escape has ended the same way. And there's a sharper edge to it, because he's noticed something. His wife's suggestion to wear earplugs constantly in the bedroom has backfired. The one place he expected peace has become another environment where noise happens unpredictably. So today we're going to dig into what chronic construction noise does to a mind that can't filter it, and whether the real enemy is the drilling or the helplessness.
The thing about Daniel's situation that jumps out at me immediately is that it's a perfect storm of three separate problems that all amplify each other. You've got the sensory piece, which is real and physiological. You've got the environmental piece, which is Jerusalem construction, and that's not going anywhere. And then you've got the psychological piece, which is the learned pattern of being trapped. Any one of those is manageable. All three at once, with a toddler in the house, is brutal.
And the Jerusalem context matters more than people outside the city realize. This isn't a quiet suburb where a single renovation is an anomaly. Construction here is constant. There were protests just recently. Hardy communities pushing back against light rail construction because of the noise and the disruption. So Daniel's problem isn't a personal failure to find a quiet apartment. It's the baseline condition of the city right now.
Right, and that's the first thing I'd want to name. The framing of, we keep choosing badly, is wrong. The pattern Daniel describes, viewing a place as quiet, getting assured it's quiet, then construction starts, that's not bad luck. That's a structural feature of a city in a building boom with a rental vacancy rate under 2%. You don't get to be picky. You take what exists, and what exists is loud.
And the agent assures you it's quiet because the agent's incentive is to sign the lease, not to do a 3-month noise audit. So Daniel's been trained by repeated experience to expect betrayal from the environment. That's not paranoia. That's pattern recognition. But here's where it gets interesting psychologically. Let's talk about what's actually happening in his brain when that jackhammer starts.
So the ADHD piece is crucial here, and it's often misunderstood. People think sound sensitivity with ADHD is about being annoyed more easily. It's not. It's about auditory filtering. Most brains have a mechanism that sorts incoming sound into relevant and irrelevant, and it does this automatically. The sound of traffic outside, the refrigerator hum, a distant conversation, these get pushed to the background without conscious effort. In ADHD, that filtering is weaker. The brain treats a lot of sounds as equally salient, so the jackhammer doesn't stay in the background. It keeps announcing itself over and over as if it's new information each time.
Which means the cognitive cost isn't just the annoyance. It's the constant, involuntary attention capture. Every time the drill changes rhythm or pauses and restarts, his brain has to reevaluate. Is this a threat? Is this relevant? What changed? That's exhausting in a way that constant noise isn't. A steady fan or white noise is easy to tune out. Intermittent, unpredictable construction noise is the worst possible profile.
And there's research that backs this up. There was a longitudinal study in Turcot looking at construction noise annoyance over time. The finding that's relevant to Daniel is that annoyance levels didn't track with decibels. They tracked with perceived control and predictability. When residents felt informed about what was happening and when it'd end, their annoyance stayed lower even when the noise was objectively loud. When they felt unheard, annoyance stayed high even after the noise dropped.
So the AI excavation analysis Daniel did, feeding photos in to understand the project. That's not just a quirky technologist thing. That's him reaching for exactly the variable that the research says matters. Predictability. If he can know the timeline, even if the timeline is bad, it reduces the helplessness. The problem is the AI told him it could go on for years, which is an honest answer but a psychologically brutal one.
And that's the trap. He sought information to gain control, and the information he got removed the hope. So now he's in a situation where the one coping mechanism that works, knowing the timeline, has been neutralized by the timeline being terrible. That's hard. I want to talk about the earplugs, though, because that's the part of his prompt that I think is the most clinically interesting.
At the wife's suggestion, wear them all the time in the bedroom.
Yes. And I want to be careful here because Hannah's suggestion comes from love. She sees him suffering and she wants to fix it. But the mechanism she's proposing is avoidance. And avoidance with sensory sensitivity has a nasty feedback loop. When you wear earplugs constantly, two things happen. First, your auditory system recalibrates. The baseline for what counts as quiet shifts. The world without earplugs becomes louder by comparison because your brain has adjusted to the muffled input. Second, and this is the bigger issue, you create a vigilance loop. You're wearing the earplugs specifically because you're afraid of the noise. So now, every moment you're wearing them, your brain is monitoring. Is the noise getting through? Is it starting? Am I protected? You've turned the bedroom into a listening post.
So the earplugs become a signal that danger is imminent, rather than a tool that lets you relax. The body doesn't know the difference between, I'm wearing these to sleep, and I'm wearing these because the bombing might start. The physiological response is similar. And Daniel said it himself. The only place he expected peace is now an environment where noise occurs unpredictably. The earplugs didn't create the noise, but the constant vigilance around them made the noise feel even more intrusive.
The clinical term is fear, avoidance. It's well documented in chronic pain, and it applies to sound sensitivity too. The avoidance behavior, wearing earplugs constantly, reinforces the belief that the sound is unbearable. The more you avoid, the more convinced you become that avoidance is necessary. It's a spiral. And the exit from that spiral is counterintuitive, which we'll get to. But first I want to name the other piece, which is the learned helplessness.
This is the part that Daniel described as folding. The noise isn't what makes him fold. It's the feeling of being trapped yet again. Two unplanned moves, a leak the landlord refused to fix, a decade of instability. His brain has learned a specific lesson. When things go wrong, there's no exit that doesn't cost you everything.
Seligman's original learned helplessness experiments were about dogs who received shocks they couldn't escape. Later, when escape was possible, they didn't try. They'd learned that effort was pointless. Daniel's situation is a slow-motion version of that. Every time he's tried to solve the housing problem, by moving, by writing to the construction company, by researching the excavation, the outcome has been the same. The noise continues, the lease holds him, the cost of escape is catastrophic. So the folding isn't weakness. It's a conditioned response to a system that offers no good options.
And the lease is the mechanism that makes the trap real. A year-long commitment, moving costs that almost emptied their bank accounts, and the knowledge that even if they move, the next place will probably have the same problem. That's not learned helplessness in the pathological sense. That's accurate assessment. The helplessness is real. The question is what you do when the assessment is correct and the situation is still unbearable.
That's the hard part, and I want to sit with it for a second because I think this is where most advice fails. If someone tells Daniel to just move, they're ignoring the financial reality. If someone tells him to just accept the noise, they're ignoring the sensory reality. If someone tells him to fight the construction company, they're ignoring the legal reality in Israel. So what's left is the psychological work of changing his relationship to the noise and to the trapped feeling. Not because the situation is fine, but because it's the only variable he can actually control.
Which is a grim foundation for advice, but an honest one. So let's talk about what that psychological work actually looks like. You mentioned the fear avoidance spiral. What's the exit?
The exit is a framework called ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. And before I explain it, I want to be clear that I'm not saying Daniel should just think positive thoughts about the jackhammer. That's not what acceptance means here. Acceptance in ACT means choosing to experience discomfort without fighting it, because the fighting is what creates the suffering. There's a distinction between pain and suffering. The pain is the noise. The suffering is the mental loop of, this will never end, I'm trapped, I can't bear this. ACT targets the suffering, not the pain.
So the noise stays. The relationship to the noise changes.
And there are specific techniques. One is called diffusion. The idea is that you don't have to believe every thought your brain produces. When Daniel's mind says this will never end, the natural response is to fuse with that thought, to treat it as reality, and to spiral. Diffusion is the practice of stepping back and noticing the thought as a thought. The classic exercise is to say to yourself, I notice I'm having the thought that this will never end. That little bit of distance changes the relationship. The thought is still there. The jackhammer is still there. But you're no longer inside the thought. You're observing it.
And that's trainable. It's not a personality trait. You practice it the same way you practice anything else. The first time you try it during a 7 a.m. jackhammer session, it'll feel ridiculous. The 50th time, it starts to work.
There's actually a whole body of work on this for tinnitus, which is a useful parallel because tinnitus is a sound you can't escape and can't control. The ACT approach for tinnitus doesn't try to make the sound go away. It tries to reduce the distress the sound causes. People learn to notice the ringing without the panic response. The sound becomes neutral, just another part of the sensory landscape. Construction noise can be approached the same way. Not because it's pleasant, but because the panic response is what's making it unbearable.
And the panic response is fed by the unpredictability. So, another piece of the work is creating predictability where the construction company won't. Daniel already knows the schedule. 7 to 4, 6 days a week, Shabbat off. That's actually a lot of information. The problem is the internal schedule, the pauses and restarts within those hours. But there's a technique called scheduled exposure that might help. Instead of wearing earplugs as a defensive reflex, he can choose specific windows where he sits with the noise unmuffled with the diffusion practice and treats it as a training session. The choice is what matters. He's choosing to experience it, not being ambushed by it.
That's the key distinction. Passive suffering versus active willingness. Willingness is an ACT term, and it means opening up to discomfort on purpose, as a choice, because the alternative, constant vigilance and avoidance, is worse. The earplugs go from a panic response to a tool he uses when he needs to focus or sleep, not a shield he never takes off. And the bedroom, which has become a listening post, can become a place where he sometimes just lets the noise be there, notices the thoughts, and doesn't fight them.
There's a reframe here that I think is important. Daniel described the DIY work at his in-law's summer home as empowering because he was creating lasting value in a stable property. The rental feels like the opposite. Every improvement requires permission. Every expense is lost. Nothing lasts. But the psychological need underneath that isn't actually about property value. It's about agency. It's about seeing that your actions change your environment in a way that persists. And there are microversions of that available in a rental.
Right, the temporary landlord-friendly modifications. Things that can be undone but that still change the space in a way that matters. Acoustic panels that hang on walls without damaging them. Thick curtains that absorb sound and can be taken down. A white noise machine that gives him control over the auditory environment even if it can't eliminate the jackhammer. The point isn't to soundproof the apartment. The point is to reestablish the sense that he can act on his environment and see a result.
And that's the piece that's been missing. The construction company doesn't respond. The landlord doesn't fix the leak. The agent lies about the quiet. Every attempt to act on the environment fails. So the DIY work becomes a place where action produces a visible result. The psychological need is for efficacy. The scale is smaller in a rental, but it's not zero.
I want to talk about the couple's piece too, because Daniel and Hannah are navigating a real conflict. She needs centrality. He needs quiet and stability. Those aren't compatible in Jerusalem right now. And the pattern they're in is that they keep choosing places that seem quiet and turn out not to be. The fix isn't to find the perfect apartment. It's to change the decision process so that quiet is evaluated more honestly.
A sensory audit. Visit the apartment at different times of day. 7 a.m. on a weekday, not just a Sunday afternoon. Talk to neighbors about construction. Check municipal planning records for nearby projects. Daniel's already doing the AI excavation analysis, which is a version of this. The point is to front-load the information gathering so the decision isn't made on the agent's assurance.
Even then, no place is guaranteed quiet. Jerusalem is a city under construction. The light rail, the housing boom, the constant renovation. So the goal can't be finding the silent apartment. The goal has to be building the resilience to live with the noise when it arrives. That's a different kind of decision. It's not, is this place quiet? It's, can we function here even if it isn't? And that changes what you look for. You look for the room that can be an office away from the street. You look for the thick walls. You look for the building that's already finished its renovations.
The residential instability piece is the deeper wound, though. Daniel's been through two unplanned moves that almost emptied their accounts. Research on residential instability shows it's a chronic stressor on the same level as job insecurity. It undermines identity, it disrupts social networks, it makes it impossible to plan. And with a 14-month-old, the stakes feel existential. He's not just trying to find a quiet place for himself. He's trying to build a stable home for his son, and the market is telling him that stability is a luxury he can't afford.
That's the part that makes this more than a noise complaint. The noise is the acute trigger, but the underlying condition is a decade of housing precarity, and precarity does something specific to the brain. It shrinks the time horizon. You stop thinking in years and start thinking in weeks. You stop investing in the present because you've learned it can be taken away. Daniel's DIY at the in-law's place felt good because it was the opposite of that. It was long-term thinking. It was building something that would last. The rental doesn't allow that, and the psychological cost is real.
The existential reframe has to address that directly. The drilling could last years. That's what the AI said. And assuming it'll last years is catastrophic thinking, which is its own problem. But the deeper issue is that even if the drilling stops tomorrow, the feeling of being trapped doesn't automatically go away. The pattern has been installed. The next place will have something. The next agent will lie. The next lease will be a trap. That's the thought loop that needs diffusion, not the noise itself.
That's where radical acceptance comes in, not resignation. Resignation is giving up, and it comes with the collapse of agency. Radical acceptance is seeing the situation clearly, including the parts you can't change, and choosing to stop spending energy fighting reality. The noise is here, the lease is a year, the market is brutal. Those are facts. The suffering comes from fighting them, from the constant, this shouldn't be happening, I shouldn't have to deal with this. The shouldn't is the problem. It's true he shouldn't have to deal with this, and he does. Both things are true. Acceptance means holding both without the second one becoming a spiral.
There's a grounding technique that pairs well with this. When the catastrophic thinking starts, the this will never end, I'll never be happy here, the counter is to come back to the present moment. What's actually happening right now? The jackhammer is loud. The room is warm. The coffee is hot. The sun is asleep. The present moment, even with the noise, is usually more bearable than the imagined future where the noise never stops. The catastrophic thought is about the future. The present is just this moment, and this moment is survivable.
The I'll never be happy in a place where I can hear drilling in the bedroom thought is worth examining too. That's a fusion with a thought. It's a prediction about the future presented as a fact about the self. The diffusion move is, I notice I'm having the thought that I'll never be happy here. And then the question, is that true, or is that the fear talking? Because people are remarkably adaptable. The brain habituates to almost anything, given time and the right framework. The noise might become the background texture of life, annoying but not catastrophic. That's not guaranteed, but neither is the catastrophe.
The home office is a concrete step in the right direction. He said it's almost set up, and that'll get him out of the bedroom, which is the place where the noise and the trap feeling are most fused. The bedroom has become the symbol of the problem. The office can be a space that's his, that's functional, that has a door. That's a real mitigation, not a psychological trick.
The occupational therapy idea is a good one. He's identified that much of his stress is sensory triggers, and OT is exactly the field that works on sensory processing. An occupational therapist can do a proper sensory assessment, figure out what specific frequencies or patterns are most triggering, and design a sensory diet that gives him the input he needs to regulate. It's not just about the ears. It's about the whole nervous system.
The practical psychological first aid, if we're making a list, is something like this. 1. Diffusion practice for the catastrophic thoughts. 2. Scheduled exposure to the noise with willingness instead of reflexive earplug use. 3. Micro-agency projects in the rental that show him he can still act on his environment. 4. A sensory audit process for future decisions that front-loads real information. 5. Occupational therapy for the sensory piece. And 6. Radical acceptance of the things that can't be changed, paired with grounding in the present moment.
I'd add a 7th, couples alignment. Daniel and Hannah need to be on the same page about what the goal is, not find the quiet place because that doesn't exist, but build a life that can function even when the city is loud. That's a different conversation, and it's one where her centrality need and his quiet need can actually coexist. Centrality gives her access to family and community. Quiet gives him the ability to work and regulate. Both are legitimate. The question is how to satisfy both within the constraints of the market, and that requires creative thinking about space, schedule, and priorities.
The home office is part of that. If he can work from a room that's not the bedroom can be for sleep and rest, and the noise in the bedroom becomes less catastrophic because it's not interrupting his work. The spaces have different functions, and the noise in one doesn't contaminate the other.
There's a broader point here about urban mental health that I think is worth naming. Jerusalem isn't unique. Cities everywhere are in a construction boom, and the people who live in them are increasingly exposed to chronic noise. The research on noise annoyance is clear that it's not just a nuisance, it's a public health issue. Cardiovascular effects, sleep disruption, cognitive impairment in children, and the psychological effects we've been discussing. The hearty protests against the light rail are a sign of what's coming. As the city densifies, more people will be in Daniel's position. The question of how to live with construction noise isn't a personal problem, it's a collective one.
The collective answer is probably a mix of better regulation, better communication from construction companies, and better psychological tools for residents. The Turcotte study showed that annoyance drops when people feel informed. So there's a policy lever here. Construction companies that provide clear timelines and respond to resident inquiries aren't just being nice. They're reducing the psychological harm that projects cause. Daniel's letter to the construction company wasn't unreasonable. It was a request for exactly the thing that the research says matters.
The fact that he got no useful response is part of why he's suffering. If the company had said, "We'll be done in 6 weeks," the annoyance would be manageable. If they'd said, "We'll be done in 2 years," at least he'd know. The silence is what makes it unbearable. It's the not knowing that feeds the catastrophic thinking.
The AI gave him an answer, but it was the worst-case answer, and now he's stuck with it. The catastrophic thought has a data point to anchor to. That's the danger of seeking information when you're already in a fear state. The information gets absorbed into the fear, not into the planning.
Which is why the diffusion work matters so much. The thought, "This could last years," isn't the same as "This will last years." The AI said it could. The construction company said nothing. The reality is unknown. The suffering comes from treating the worst case as the certain case.
Hilbert's been quiet back there.
He's been making a face.
Bosch GSH-27, 11 kilograms. I lived above a parking garage excavation in Tel Aviv for 11 months. Ground floor, the bedroom wall shared with the retaining wall they were cutting into. The jackhammer started at 6:30. I worked nights at the radio station, so I'd come home at 4 in the morning and try to sleep through it. I started recording it. Had a little cassette deck, a realistic. I'd set it up by the window with the microphone pointed at the wall. Recorded the jackhammer for hours. Then I'd take the tapes to the station and mix the sounds into ambient beds for the overnight show. Slowed it down, added reverb, sounded like industrial waves. The listeners never knew they were falling asleep to a parking garage. Didn't stop the noise, didn't make it quieter, but it was mine. The sound was happening to me, and then it was something I made. That mattered more than I expected. I still have those tapes, in a box somewhere. Sometimes I put one on to fall asleep. My wife thinks it's deranged.
You turned the thing that was torturing you into a lullaby.
That's one way to put it.
There's a name for what you did. It's a form of cognitive reappraisal. You changed the meaning of the sound by making it into music. The sound itself didn't change, but your relationship to it did. It went from threat to raw material.
I don't know about names. I just knew I couldn't keep lying there hating it. The hate was worse than the noise, so I recorded it, gave myself a job. The job was to listen. After that, it was just sound.
But you moved after 11 months.
Lease was up. The mall got built. I hear it's a very nice mall. I've never been inside.
Do you think the recording was exposure therapy, or was it just another way of avoiding the fact that you were trapped?
Both. It was both. But it was mine. That's the part that mattered.
The ownership of the experience. Not escaping it, but transforming it into something you created.
The jackhammer was going to be there either way. I could lie in bed and let it eat me, or I could tape it and make something. The second one hurt less. Not by a lot, but enough.
Now you listen to it to fall asleep. That's a complete inversion. The sound that kept you awake is now the sound that puts you under.
Brains are strange. You tell yourself a story long enough, the story becomes true. I told myself it was music. Now it's music.
That's the diffusion piece in action. You didn't stop the noise. You changed the story about the noise.
I suppose. I don't think about it much. I just know the tapes are in a box, and sometimes I want to hear them.
The box in the cupboard.
Under the bed, actually.
Of course it is.
The point is, the man in Jerusalem has a choice. He can keep fighting the sound, or he can find a way to make it his. I don't know what that looks like for him. Maybe it's the AI analysis. Maybe it's the earplugs. Maybe it's something else. But the fighting is what kills you. The sound just is.
That's the radical acceptance piece, coming from a man who mixed jackhammer sounds into overnight radio. The sound just is. The suffering is the fight.
The misconception we should name here's the idea that earplugs all the time are the solution. Daniel's already discovered that they're not. The earplugs create the vigilance loop, and the vigilance is worse than the noise. The fix isn't to bop the sound completely. The fix is to change the relationship to it. Through diffusion, through scheduled exposure, through agency in small doses, through the slow work of acceptance. The noise might be there for years. The suffering doesn't have to be.
The open question we're left with is whether the goal is a quiet place or a peaceful mind inside the noise. Daniel's story suggests the second one is more achievable. Jerusalem isn't going to stop building. The light rail will keep coming. The excavations will keep going. The people who thrive here won't be the ones who find silence. They'll be the ones who learn to hold the noise without being consumed by it.
That's the work. It's not glamorous. It's not fast. But it's real, and it's available even when the lease says you can't hang a shelf without permission. The mind is the one room you can renovate without asking the landlord.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you've got a weird prompt, send it to us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.